Okay.
Gotcha.
Yep.
All right. Well, thank you. I'd just like to welcome everybody to our Council on Human Blood and Transfusion Services, and I'll turn it over to Dr. Hilbert to call the meeting to order.
Hello. I'd like to call this meeting on the New York State Council on Human Blood and Tissue Services to order. I'm Tim Hilbert, the chair of the council.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Matthew Cohn, council secretary. As a reminder to our members and guests, the meeting is being recorded, and this recording will be available to the public on the DOH website. So please speak loudly and clearly when you need to speak. Speak one at a time, to the extent possible. State your name before making or seconding a motion. And perhaps most importantly, please do mute if you are not talking. Okay, Dr. Hilbert, back to you.
First, I'd like to welcome our newest member, Dr. Joanne Becker. Dr. Becker is the medical director of the Blood Bank and Therapeutic Apheresis Unit and the vice chair of the Division of Laboratory Medicine in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at Roswell Park Cancer Center. Dr. Becker, welcome. Would you like to say anything?
I don't think I get anything to what you just said.
Okay, thank you. Now I'd like the rest of the council and staff to introduce themselves by stating their names and their affiliations. First, Dr. Elder.
You hear me okay? I'm unmuted. I'm Rachel Elder. I'm the medical director at the Krauss Hospital and the lab director there too.
Dr. Husky.
I'm David Husky, the governor's designated representative for the people of the state of New York.
Dr. Jacobson, is she attending?
She was going to try and call in, but it looks like she has not yet managed to do so.
Okay. Dr. McCarthy?
Hello, Philip McCarthy from Roswell Park in Buffalo, New York.
Dr. Schmidt.
Hi, I'm Dr. Amy Schmidt with Medical Director of Transfusion Medicine and Blood Collections at HCA Healthcare Continental Division.
Thank you. Ms. Roush.
And I'm Beverly Roush. I'm the acting director of the Blood Resources Program and the deputy division director for the Division of Laboratory Quality Certification at the Wadsworth Center of the New York State Department of Health.
And now the DOH staff in attendance will introduce themselves.
I'm Mary Beth Dooley. I work with the Blood Resources Program at the Wadsworth Center.
Again, Matthew Cohn, secretary to the council. We have a couple of colleagues from LA. Go ahead, Jason.
Yep. Hi, this is Jason Riegert. I'm the deputy director of the Bureau of Program Council here at the Department of Health.
And Alexa?
Hi, Alexa Nagy, and I'm a senior attorney also in the Bureau of Program Council.
Okay, as always, I'd like to thank our council members for your time and efforts. I'm going to introduce members of the public who are attending today's meeting. I will announce each registered participant. There is time reserved at the end of the meeting for public comment. Today's participants include Mary Beth Parachi from New York Blood Center, Eric Sinaldi from New York Blood Center, Sarah Vazogi from New York Blood Center, Mark Houston from Farrell Fritz, Heather Pratt from KED Plasma, Suzanne Brandt from New York Blood Center, Alexandra Budhai from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Maria Loker from American Red Cross, and Evan Waldron from New York Blood Center. Our agenda today includes approval of the minutes of our September 13th, 2023 meeting, a discussion of changes to regulations regarding ambulance transfusion services, review and possible voting on revisions to one of the blood services guideline documents, and a discussion of qualification requirements for hematopoietic progenitor cell bank directors and medical directors. Okay, Dr. Hilbert. Dr. Hilbert, you're on mute.
Sorry. Our first order of business is the approval of the minutes to our September 13th, 2023 meeting. Is there any discussion of those minutes? So, not hearing any comments, may I have a motion to approve the minutes as presented with the edits discussed or lack thereof?
This is Rachel Elder. I'll move to for the approval of the minutes of September 13th.
And a second?
This is Amy Schmidt. I'll second.
Okay, thank you. And roll call vote. So Dr. Becker, would you like to approve?
Approve.
Dr. Elder?
That wasn't approved, but I'm getting a lot of feedback.
Thank you. Mr. Husky?
Approve.
I see Jessica's still not on, so.
Correct.
Dr. McCarthy?
Approve.
Okay, and then I guess Beverly, you approved already, and Amy did as well. So I vote aye to approve. So the motion is approved. Our second order of business, moving on, is a discussion of the ambulance transfusion service. I'll turn this over to Ms. Rausch to describe the regulations.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Hilbert. So just as some background, in 2022, Section 3003B of Article 30 of the Public Health Law was signed into law authorizing ambulance services that provide transportation by aircraft to store, distribute, and administer blood. And then during the last legislative session, legislation was passed that expanded this section of Article 30 to include any, that being ground or air, ambulance service or advanced life support first response service to store, distribute, and administer blood. So as you know, subpart 58.2 of Title 10 of the New York Code Rules and Regulations, which this council votes on the adoption, includes requirements for the ambulance transfusion services for interfacility transport. So essentially upon adoption of this new law, once Governor Hochul signs this law, the authority to promulgate rules, regs, and rules and regulations governing the storage, distribution, administration of blood by ambulance services and advanced life support first response services will be granted to the State Emergency Medical Services Council rather than our council. And the administrative processes for the management of those approvals for those ambulance services will be handled by the department's Bureau of Emergency Medical Services. So that means that Section 58-2.20 of our Title 10, which is the section titled Ambulance Transfusion Services, will become obsolete. So as mentioned, as of today, the legislation has not in fact been signed by the governor, but anticipation of adoption of this law, I'm asking for the council to consider a vote to repeal Section 58.2.20 of Title 10. And of course, that would be pending the governor's final approval of the bill. Are there any questions or discussion on this topic?
I mean, I guess my question would be just to clarify. So there would be no more authority for you guys to regulate once this goes into effect. I mean, is that how it works?
Right. So the authority would be established in law. And that, because right now the only authority we have is in the regulation, and this law would actually supersede that authority in the reg, as far as I understand it.
So it doesn't seem like any alternative to that, right? I mean, it's not, the authority will be superseded and therefore the regulation will not be binding or effective and therefore should go away, right?
That's how we are viewing it, yes. And I will say that we have been, Mary Beth and myself and other members helping on the Blood Resources Program, we have been in discussions with the Bureau of Emergency Medical Services as they are developing their regulations to oversee this process. So there are individuals with knowledge of the Blood Resources Program involved in the development of those regs.
This is Rachel Elder. I guess I'm confused. You mean we can't do it dual, that there might be something that we would want them to do that they don't want to do? I mean, how does that work if there's... So you'll have people on there that will make sure that it is stored properly, and I guess I don't understand, if it's blood and transfusion, why we would lose, they would take that over?
So there will be, so there's the first part of the question to address that. The regulations that I've seen do talk about the fact that the blood needs to be stored in accordance with all of the FDA rules. So they would have to be stored properly, would have to be stored in appropriate refrigerators or validated coolers. All of the requirements that we impose right now would still be part of the new regulation. And then as far as the, you know, our authority, that's a legal question, so I may have to defer to counsel, but my understanding is the ambulance transfusion services registration process prior to the Article 30 amendment, it's only in our regulation. We don't actually have a clear statutory authority for that particular registration process, where now there will be a clear statutory authority in Article 30 for those ambulance services to administer blood. And it's been, I'm trying to think of, I don't think at that point, the ambulance wouldn't be considered what would be referred to as a defined in law as a blood bank at that point. And that's why it's being, the authority kind of shifts from us over to the Bureau of EMS.
This is Dr. Schmidt. I have a quick question. So when you're saying that they're being approved for storage, are you talking about storage in the aspect of they pick up blood in the earlier part of the day, they ride it around with it, and then they put it back? Like, who's overseeing it and where are they getting it from? And are they allowed to store it for days on end? Like, are they getting it from a supplier? Are they picking up from the hospital and then returning it to the hospital at the end of the day? Like, what is their quote unquote storage? Is there storage long term? Is there storage for an 8-hour shift?
So there's a variety of models that I've been made aware of. So as noted, the original law was adopted in 2022 with the air ambulances. So there are actually experiences so far with how the air ambulances are managing this. In some cases, those air ambulances actually have blood bank refrigerators in their hangars, and they store emergency uncross matched blood in those hangars for pre-hospital trauma situations. So there's, I think, the major difference between what we currently cover, which is only the interfacility transports, is that this new law would, for the air ambulances right now, that the law that's in effect, it covers both pre-hospital and interfacility transports, or any transports by an ambulance to be able to store and administer blood. So in effect, I've heard of scenarios where the air ambulances are, like I said, having a refrigerator, a blood bank grade refrigerator in their hangar to store uncross matched blood. There's other situations where they have a scheduled transport, an interfacility transport, and they do take the blood from the issuing blood bank and transport that patient to the receiving blood bank. So there's, it is a, covers kind of a full gamut of possible scenarios. My understanding is that any of the storage would be in accordance with typical federal requirements for the length of storage and proper conditions of storage for any of the blood. Use of a validated cooler. I could not be stored beyond the storage time of that validated cooler. So they, I think there is a, an effort that these ambulances are well are informed on about the FDA regulations and are following them to their ability.
I'm kind of in agreement with Dr. Elders. Why don't we, why does it all have to be all or nothing? I think that it should be a shared oversight. I don't think we should pull out 100%, but rather, you know, keep our hand in the pot with oversight. I don't think it's mutually exclusive.
This is Rachel Elder again. Oh, I'm sorry. Can I just ask, will it be two different strategies? Are all ambulances going to be licensed and we're going to have to know they're licensed if we give them a unit of blood, or would they be like unlicensed ambulances that want blood, or how, I mean, currently.
Go ahead. The Bureau of Emergency Medical Services does, in fact, I'm not sure if the proper term is licensed, but they do oversee all ambulance services in the state, and they have to get appropriate approvals through that bureau. And then they also, and I know with the fact with the air ambulances, they have to get approval for the distribution of blood as well. I mean, that's a special service that's operated, that's included on their operating certificate. To be able to administer blood. So there is oversight already by the Bureau of EMS for these types of services. And I think our ambulance transfusion service was kind of a layer that was added on top of Bureau of EMS's authority already. So I will say that our registration process does not, it never has included any type of on-site inspection, where under Bureau of EMS authority, they do inspect those facilities. But our regulation never contemplated any kind of inspection. So what we have been doing is just a registration process. They apply, they provide us with certain documentation, like the agreements between the hospital and the ambulance service, and then provide their training documents for their staff, and that, you know, and then they just, that's renewed every 4 years, I believe. Is that correct, Mary Beth?
I believe so.
Yeah. So it's a 4-year registration, but that's the extent of our, essentially our oversight based on the authority given to us in the reg at the moment.
I mean, it sounds like that under the regulation, if passed, that the authority will shift to EMS and that it'll be their responsibility and authority to create rules and definitions and all of those things that govern or that, you know, regulate in some way these activities. Is that correct? It'll just go outside of laboratory.
That is my understanding. It goes, the authority falls under the Bureau of Emergency Medical Services. There's two hands raised, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I didn't see those. Dr. Becker and Dr. Schmidt. So Dr. Becker, would you like to add something? Do you have a question? Looks like your hand is up.
Yes. Okay, we're working. Okay, thanks. I happen to be involved with an ambulance service through my role at Connect Life. So I can tell you that the documentation that we have with them, as far as them accepting the products, how they're stored, and then the agreements they have with the final hospitals for how they handle transfusion reactions and their ability to trace back units, it's pretty extensive. So they keep a couple of units of whole blood in their hangers, and then they take it with them when they need it. Another piece that I'm not sure if it's come up is that they need to have either an NP or a physician on board who can actually order the unit of blood that they're giving during the trauma. So it's not being just given by anyone, and that's part of the ambulance program that we've got. So I'm not as worried because it's not covered by Department of Health now. It's covered through the EMS service. So if they've got that, then it's relatively safe.
Thank you. That's a good point. And you know, any with an emergency medical services, they're all always under medical control anytime they're en route. So and that they do have to have, you know, an authorized ordering source for any of those blood transfusions. So very good point, Dr. Becker. Thank you.
Dr. Schmidt, you have a hand up.
Yes. Can we have the exact wording of the legislation to review before we make a final decision so that we can, kind of like, because there's some ambiguity about whether or not it removes things and exactly what it says. So sometimes it's written so vaguely that it doesn't actually move it from one aspect to the other and abolish one rule over the other. It might move it into the other arena, but it doesn't eliminate our arena. So I would rather read it and see what it exactly says.
Sure. I can read it aloud. It also is Senate number 6226-A is the actual bill, but I can read the amendments. So section 1, section 3003-B of the public health law, as amended by Chapter 61 of the laws of 2022, is amended to read as follows. 3003-B, availability of ambulance service, and what's the new language is, and advanced life support first response service, and the language that was stricken that says, referring to an ambulance service that it says that provides transportation by aircraft, that was stricken. And new language says, you know, ambulance service and advanced life support first response service, to allowing them to store and distribute blood and initiate and administer blood transfusion. And then there's this, I think the section number 2-1 says an ambulance service or advanced life support first response service licensed under this article may store and distribute human blood and blood products at all their facilities and qualified medical and health personnel as defined in this article, operating within an ambulance service or advanced life support first response service licensed under this article, may initiate and administer human blood and blood product transfusions while providing such ambulance services or advanced life support care via advanced life support mobile unit. And then it does go on in section 2 of section of 3003-B, stating notwithstanding Title 5 of Article 5 of this chapter, any ambulance service or advanced life support first response service licensed under this article may store and distribute human blood and blood products in accordance with standards for the storage of human blood products of the United States Food and Drug Administration. So my understanding of that language where it says nothing withstanding Title 5, Article 5. Title 5, Article 5 is the statutory authority under which clinical laboratories and blood banks exist. So by that language essentially does negate our authority for these entities moving forward. And it does talk about the State Emergency Medical Services Council, with approval of the commissioner, shall promulgate rules and regulations to effectuate the purposes of this section. So it does transfer the authority of the promulgation of rules and regs to the Emergency Medical Council rather than our council.
This is partially ignorance on my part, but so emergency medicals or the Bureau of Emergency Medical Services, that's not part of DOH, right? That's a separate.
It is. It's a different branch of DOH. It is under the Office of Primary Care and Health Systems Management. So it's a different office of the Department of Health.
It falls under
and they're okay. And they're managed by a different council.
Okay. I mean, the way I see it is that if the authority is being taken away under this new regulation, then the old regulation doesn't have any weight anyway, right? It's just, it would be just fluff if it's superseded by the new reg.
Yeah, the way it's written, where it's talking about that it's essentially notwithstanding Title V, Article V, that's our Article 5, Title 5 is our authority for oversight of clinical laboratories and blood banks. We wrapped in the ambulance transfusion services as part of that Article 5, Title 5 authority. And now they're saying that they can do it under Article 30 for those entities.
Okay. I mean, the way I see it, it's not really an issue whether we think it's appropriate or not. It's a question of whether it gets passed and now falls beyond the scope of 58.
So I think the motion, should we entertain one, would be to, following the governor's signing of the law, of the bill, to repeal this section of the regulation. But if the governor does not sign it, this section of the regulation would remain.
Yep. I will say that the original law that was signed in 2022, we don't have authority over any air ambulances at this moment. We only have authority over ground ambulances. So that was one of the effects of the 2022 law.
I mean, I'm guessing that there's a difference, though, right? Most air ambulances are very closely associated with hospitals that they're part of, whereas there's a lot more ambulance services, you know, that are private in some way. And I mean, there's just a lot more, bigger number of them, plain old car ambulance services. So the oversight burden is probably a little bit bigger with respect to that, or could become bigger if there are lots of people who choose to engage in these kinds of activities, but that's seems beyond our scope.
Yeah, and I can say that after discussions with Bureau of Emergency Medical Services is that they only allow ambulance services that have advanced life support to be able to do this. So a first responder approval or a basic life support approval, they would not be allowed to provide this service. They have to have a paramedic. At a minimum, they can't have a standard EMT to be able to administer blood. So they'd have to have at least a paramedic. So there are controls because of the scope of the practice of those EMTs versus a paramedic too. And then I think in some of these entities, they would be bringing on board nurses, or registered nurses, or other staff members potentially from the issuing blood bank.
So is that requirement consistent with the current scope of ambulance services that you guys have been approving?
There are requirements already in Section 20 that talk about the paramedics being the ones that can initiate the blood administration, the blood transfusions.
Dr. Elder, you have your hand up.
Yeah, I figured out how to get my hand up. Sorry. I guess that is my question. The ones we see are not advanced life support. There's somebody that wants to be transported to another place. And I thought that, is there going to be a gap in the transfusions that occur in ambulances that are for transport of a patient that is not trauma? They're not storing it. They're just, and we were trying to make sure that we heard about the transfusion, that they transfused it or told us what happened. So are they, these ambulances that not are not your life support ones, going to be underneath this also? Or is there a gap in that kind of transfusion? That's what we see. We're not giving blood to air ambulances or advanced.
So I don't believe that all we have experience with right now are the area ambulances that have been administering blood under this 2022 law. And in those cases, when they roll, that's usually for a trauma situation. So they are carrying the uncrossed matched emergency release blood, or there's a scheduled transport. I think at our discussions with Bureau of EMS, what they're envisioning is there's going to be those pre-hospital trauma situations. Many times, I don't think, at least from our impression from Bureau of EMS, is that many of the ambulances don't intend to drive around with blood all day long. They would go to a hospital, pick up blood as they're rolling to a scene. So I think there are guardrails already imposed by Bureau of EMS about which of the types of ambulance services will be allowed to offer this additional service.
So that is not the situations we see usually at our hospital. So they're just transporting a hospital patient to another site.
Right. Yeah, I don't think this is going to be affecting the general transports. It's going to be in the situations there where the issuing blood bank or the referring hospital, that in the current ambulance transfusion services, the physician at the hospital has to approve the order for a blood transfusion. So either the blood transfusion is already started, or there's a possibility for blood transfusion to start while in transport, but it's already been approved before that rig starts rolling. And I think it's very, like I said, there's a lot of, there still needs to be an authorized ordering source for a blood transfusion in the rig. So if a typical routine transport, I don't think that's going to be an issue at all. I think it's going to be people that are already at risk where transfusion's already been started and they need to be transferred to a higher level hospital. Or it's transfusing, they start transfusion in the field and moving them to the hospital.
Feel really old. I think we started this discussion, I don't know how long ago, because people wanted to transport patients in the ambulances in New York City, as I recall, and it wasn't the trauma. And you have a storage. Does this even address that kind of patient transport? Because we were worried about giving a unit, yes, the physician ordered it, but the person giving the blood knows nothing about transfusion reactions. And we did want somebody trained in the ambulance that was transfusing. So, or we gave them units because they were worried. So I recall this was a whole lot of making sure there was paperwork, and these are random ambulances. So I don't even know if this addresses that, but we used to try to figure out making sure we had everything set with the hospital that the patient was going to. So I can see the transport is a little different or the storage, but are we going to miss making sure that everything's okay for the transport and transfusion during an ambulance ride or a regular ambulance?
When in our discussions with the Bureau of EMS, we did stress the fact that the people administering the blood would have to be appropriately trained in transfusion and recognizing adverse events so that they would be able to, you know, stop the transfusion if necessary. We did stress that requirement. That was a necessity when they promulgate those new regulations.
But I think what the question is, or part of it is, under the new regulation, those activities, both transfusion by an air ambulance or an ambulance that stores blood, and this sort of more routine transfusion during transport, all of those would fall out of the purview of the current regulation and under the Bureau of Emergency Medical Services. Is that
correct?
That is
my understanding, yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it would be all storage, distribution, administration of blood by an ambulance service or the Advanced Life Support First Response Service. That's
so if a hospital gives a unit of blood to an ambulance that's going from point A to point B, it'll be the responsibility of Bureau of Emergency Medical Services to create regulations that control that rather than us or you guys or DOH.
Correct. Yeah, I have heard that the forms of the transfusion records and things like that, I have heard that they plan on using those same forms by the Bureau of EMS. So there is an intention for them to ensure that there is proper documentation of any transfusions occurring in those ambulances.
That's your... Mm-hmm.
And is there, I mean, I'm sure that they feel as though you guys would be a resource to them for any questions related to these transfusion activities. Is there anything else we need to do in terms of handoff that, or, you know, they would just come back to you if they needed anything?
We definitely have offered our services to them. And as I mentioned, prior to this law going into effect, we've been working with them on the regulations that they are developing for the air ambulances. So we do have a relationship built up. So we do anticipate that they would come back to us with any questions should any arise. We've been working hard to build up that relationship.
Does the council want to put together some sort of document that we could share with BEMS or the council they consult with to stress our concerns? That's something we could certainly put together. You know, share what our council's historical concerns were so that they are aware.
Is that something people would be interested in doing? Or we could send a letter and just, you know, say that we have some concerns, however, and if there are issues that come up, we would be happy to provide any assistance.
Okay. That's reasonable.
I mean, it sounds like they do have experience in it, although it's unfamiliar to us, but certainly, if there's questions, you know, we could, you know, summarize our experience and assist in any way.
So the concerns that I heard were proper training of staff, proper documentation, meaning proper documentation of the actual administration of the blood and physician order.
Yeah, just to understand the scope of it, because, you know, we realize that there are multiple different settings in which these transfusions would occur, both emergency and in sort of non-emergent or less emergent transport of patients within a hospital network, just to make sure that all of those things are covered adequately. And if there are any concerns or, you know, questions about that, then, you know, we could help. Maybe other people have other things, though.
My concern is about the blood storage and temperature monitoring, you know, both on the ride as well as pre-ride or after the ride, you know, how all that's going to be tracked, temperature monitoring, oversight, and things like that.
Okay.
I also wonder about where they're getting the blood from. I mean, all the units we talk about are transfusion committee. Is there any oversight about what units, if they're, you know, what's happening with them? And, you know, are we are in a blood shortage. Are we using them? Are we not using them? Who has the oversight of that? And if we give them units, do we, you know, the big thing was having some sort of contract with them? Who's, you know, what are we responsible if they come and they want to take some units? How is that all worked out?
We have to have the agreement. Well, that was going to be in their proposed rate, their timeline agreement as well, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I believe in the draft regulations we were looking at, there was a talk about an inclusion of an agreement between the ambulance services and the issuing blood banks. And then for some of the other facilities that would be maintaining their own blood supply in their blood bank grade refrigerator, they may actually have an agreement with, you know, a blood supplier such as American Red Cross or New York Blood Center or other facilities like that. So there, I think there's going to be a variety of models as this matures. And so, and I, that's one, I think one of the struggles with trying to, I mean, our focus was very narrow because it was just interfacility transport. So it was very easy to hold an issuing blood bank requirement and then a receiving blood bank requirement and the idea of like a pre-transfusion specimen collection, things like that. It was very easy, but I think within in the new models, it's going to be covering not just those interfacility transport, which are much more controlled, but also these pre-hospital transports where there may be times when like a pre-transfusion specimen would not be able to be obtained. Which, yes, we understand that would complicate any transfusion reaction workups, but in some cases it would be unavoidable. So I think there's going to be a variety of issues that will present itself as this matures.
And if this goes into effect for the regulations, does that mean that the authority will will it be day one or is there a phase-in period at which there's a transfer where that will be built into whatever repeal vote we take? Is that how it works?
So my understanding is once this legislation is signed by the governor, that clause about, you know, notwithstanding Title V, Article V, any ambulance services licensed under Article 30 may store and distribute blood in accordance with the FDA requirements. I believe that becomes immediately in effect. And I think, okay, sorry. No, there actually is a clause that says this act shall take effect on the 90th day after it shall become a law. So, so it would be, I guess, a 90-day transition period.
I mean, that's relatively quick.
Given the length of time it takes to promulgate regulations. Yes.
It'll be beyond, yeah.
Okay, well, I guess we need to vote on this regardless. With the discussion that we've had, I think it's appropriate to repeal if the legislation passes and is signed into law. Is that where we're at?
I think so. We need a motion and a second if that's what the council agrees to. I think we need the motion anyway, whether the council votes in support or not.
A motion to vote on it, right?
Yep.
Right.
So who submits the motion?
I motion to vote on the repeal of 58-2.20.
Okay. Is there a second?
Upon the signing, I'm sorry, you're right. Upon the signing of that, of S-6226A of into law by Governor Hochul.
I'll second.
Okay, and then the roll call vote. So Mr. Becker or Dr. Becker, sorry.
I agree.
Dr. Elder?
I'm going to abstain.
Okay. Mr. Husky?
I agree.
Uh, Jessica is still not here. So Dr. McCarthy?
I agree.
Ms. Rausch?
I agree.
And Dr. Schmidt?
Just out of curiosity, do we have to have a majority, or what do we have to have?
My understanding is we need a majority to vote for it.
And what does abstaining do?
Reduces the total number of votes.
But it doesn't necessarily count against it.
Correct.
I agree.
I vote yes. The motion is approved, I guess.
Thank you.
Okay. The next order of business is a discussion of certain blood service guidelines. There's one guideline on the transfusion agenda. Elective out-of-hospital transfusion, recommended criteria and guidelines for transfusion of blood components. We reviewed this last year, and the department staff have made updates accordingly. Ms. Rausch will describe the guideline and lead the discussion. Beverly?
Oh, thank you again, Dr. Hilbert. A copy of the proposed changes to the elective out-of-hospital transfusion guidelines was distributed prior to the meeting. This copy includes revisions we discussed at our last meeting. All those changes were underlined, and any deletions were bracketed. Is there any discussion on these changes? Okay, hearing none, I submit a motion to adopt the revisions to the elective out-of-hospital transfusion guidelines.
You need a second. This is Philip McCarthy. I would second it.
Dr. Hilbert, you're on mute if you are speaking.
Sorry about that. So the roll call vote, Dr. Becker.
Approve.
Dr. Elder.
Approve.
Mr. Husky.
Approve.
Jessica's absence. Dr. McCarthy voted. So Ms. Rausch.
Approve.
Dr. Schmidt.
Approve.
I vote yes, the motion is approved. The final item on our agenda, moving on to 58.5.3. The final agenda on our is the discussion of the requirement for the director of medical and medical director of hematopoietic progenitor cell banks. And Dr. Cohn will describe the current requirement.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Hilbert. Subpart 58-5 of Title 10 of the Codes, Rules, and Regulations governs hematopoietic progenitor cell, or HPC, banking in New York. And bear with me as I try and work through the nomenclature here. Section 58-5.2 includes the qualification requirements for director and medical director of HPC procurement and processing facilities. These regulations were last amended in 2004, and as you all know, the landscape of HPC transplants has changed significantly since that time. Before I describe the current requirements, I will note that any changes we propose to 58-5 will need approval of the council at a future meeting. We provided each of you with the relevant language from the regulation, but I will go through it briefly.
I'm going to start with the HPC procurement facilities. These are the facilities that are collecting the HPCs from bone marrow, peripheral blood, and or umbilical cord. As required by section 58-5.2E, paragraph 1, the director of an HPC procurement facility must be a physician who has 1 year's experience in collection of HPCs from each source that the facility collects from, namely peripheral blood, bone marrow, and cord blood. The director must also have performed or supervised 25 peripheral blood or cord blood collections, or 12 bone marrow harvests, dependent on the sources collected at their facility. And again, these requirements are found in section 58-5.2E, paragraph 1. Moving on to section 58-5.2F, to be approved as the medical director of an HPC procurement facility, the physician must have 2 years' experience or training in clinical hematology oncology that includes bone marrow transplant, or 2 years' experience in transfusion medicine. The medical director must also have 1 year of experience in HPC collection or the performance or supervision of 25 collection procedures from each source that their facility deals with. So now moving on to HPC processing facilities, as found in 58-5.2E, paragraph 2, the director must have a doctoral degree, an MD, PhD, or equivalent, and 3 years laboratory experience, including 6 months of experience in a clinical lab or blood bank. The director must also have 1 year's experience in HPC processing that includes or is supplemented by the performance or supervision of 25 processing procedures. And again, these requirements are found in 58-5.2E, paragraph 2. Finally, to be approved as the medical director of an HPC processing facility, the physician must have 2 years' experience or training in clinical hematology oncology that includes bone marrow transplant, or 2 years of experience in training in laboratory medicine or transfusion medicine. Additionally, the medical director must have either 1 year's experience in HPC processing or experience in the performance or supervision of at least 25 processing procedures. Yes, that is a lot and difficult for us to parse whenever we receive an application for a medical director or HPC bank director. And they come in relatively frequently. So I'd like to focus the discussion on the requirements for HPC procurement facilities, as that appears to be where there is a dearth of qualified personnel, or where we seem to see the greater number of issues. As the field has shifted in recent years to peripheral blood collections due to reduced stringency in matching donors with recipients, we have heard from several of our license holders that cord blood and bone marrow HPC collection procedures have decreased significantly. In particular, we have heard that there are few physicians that meet the requirement for having performed or overseen 25 collections from bone marrow required to be the medical director, and those physicians that have are nearing retirement. So what I'm looking for today is input on whether the requirements that are in the existing regulation are in need of revision, and if so, what those requirements should be. And alternatively, if there are other experts or other people we should consult with, I'd be happy to take names, numbers, and reach out to them for a discussion.
Hi, this is Dr. Schmidt.
Yeah.
So it doesn't say that you have to have experience in doing or collecting 25 bone marrow. It actually is an or, and it's only 12. So it's basically only requiring that you oversee the collection of 25 peripheral blood stem cell collections, which is, you could, if you actually were in a lab that was doing it, you could do in a couple months.
Yeah.
This is very, if someone is having trouble meeting these, that's just sad, and maybe they shouldn't be the director. But it doesn't say that you have to do 25 bone marrows, and it's an or. It says or supplemented by experience in the performance or supervision of at least 12 bone marrow collection procedures. And it doesn't say that you have to do anything with a cord. So the bare minimum is that you have to have collected or overseen the collection of 25 peripheral stem cell collections, which is very minuscule.
So thank you, you're right. It's 12 bone marrow collection procedures, but the requirements as we understand them is that if your facility is collecting from the bone marrow, you must have overseen 12 bone marrow collections or performed 12 bone marrow collections. If you're collecting from peripheral blood, you must have overseen or performed 25 peripheral blood collections. And if you're cord blood, I believe is 25 as well, if your facility is doing those. And the issue we are having is that there are so few, my understanding is there are so few bone marrow collections ongoing at a lot of facilities that there are few people, if any, who have performed or overseen 12 bone marrow HPC collections. If I am wrong, I'd be happy to receive that feedback.
So these are actually in line with that guidance, which all of these places that are performing any of this would be accredited by FACT. But a lot of people split out the directors for the bone marrow from the director of the hematopoietic stem cells. So you can split it out, but if you're going to be doing the bone marrow, the person who's doing the bone marrow needs to have overseen the bone marrow. I don't see how you can get around that.
No, I agree. The question really is, are the numbers appropriate? Are this experience, the training requirements appropriate?
Yes, and are the numbers they are, very much so.
Okay.
Hi, this is Philip McCarthy. I have a comment. So I'm one of those people who's done enough bone marrows, but I'm closer to retirement than I am to the beginning of my career. And I can tell you at our center, we have, in fact, our director has elected not to be certified for bone marrow harvest. So while it may be required by FACT, I think they're going to have to rethink this because we did zero bone marrow harvest last year. We did like two peds. So at our center, and Dr. Becker knows the data more than I do, but it's going to be a problem over the next several years because people just aren't using bone marrow and it's all peripheral blood. And so I think you're going to have to rethink that. I do think talking to the National Marrow Donor Program, in addition to FACT, would probably be a good idea because they are facing the same issue of finding qualified centers or harvest centers to do bone marrow collections.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, as Matt can tell you, we had that problem at NYU. And it's one of those things where, in order to preserve continuity, we do have people who have a lot of experience doing bone marrow biopsies and have done several bone marrow collections and transplant. And, they want to be able to still offer that activity or that service if it's necessary. And what you end up with is in a situation where you can do it, where they feel confident doing it, but from a regulatory point of view, it just makes things very complicated. You can, with FACT, you can apply for things and, submit a plan over which you will meet this requirement over, years or whatever. And it's not, FACT and DOH are different because FACT is something that you submit to voluntarily for accreditation, whereas to meet the regulations of New York State is something you're obligated to do in order to keep your license. So, we have regulations in the hospital in order to get people credentialed, minimum numbers, and those aren't necessarily the same as you're required to have to meet the New York State requirement for licensure. I just think, as you suggest, there's a lot of people who are retiring. We have a lot of people with a lot of experience just because of the ways the numbers have gone over the years.
We're doing a few more bone marrow collections now, but you know, we have people who've been in hem-onc for 10, 12 years and they don't have 12 bone marrow collections. So.
Wow. Okay. So we can certainly reach out to FACT, and we can certainly reach out to NMDP and find out what they what they're seeing, where they're heading, if they're heading somewhere different.
Organized feel from the HEMOC department here and just see who they would recommend as subject matter experts, you know, either and as organizations or as individuals who could provide input. Because it's clear to me that they see, you know, 12 as somewhat arbitrary and not necessarily describing the level of experience. Or you could have 12 and they could have been done 12 years ago and, you know, not have recent experience either. So, you know, those are relevant concerns, I think.
Yes. Okay, Dr. Hilbert, thank you. If you can provide feedback from your colleagues, that would be appreciated.
And certainly if anybody else can think of, you know, people who might be able to provide expertise or have a strong opinion about what, how this should be changed or not changed, you know, something we can entertain.
Yeah, please do send me any suggestions that you have.
Hi, this is McCarthy again. And I'm one of those people who's done a lot of bone marrow harvests. And over the last 2 years, I've done one. So you're going to have to change this because it's not going to, people won't be able to fulfill the criterion within the next few years.
Okay.
Yeah, I think what you end up with is odd situations where you have to get coverage from people, you know, who may be outside the institution, who have meet the numbers, and you know, it just creates regulatory complications. But you know, I'm happy to be persuaded either way.
I was going to say we would rather have somebody who is intimately familiar with the facility than an outside somebody who is not intimately familiar with the facility and staff but meets the letter of the regulation. We think that probably does not serve the patients well. Sorry, Dr. McCarthy, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't realize. It's just that the field has changed. We don't do bone marrow harvests except for children, and that's it. It's for adults. It's most centers have moved to the use of peripheral blood. And same thing with cord blood. Haploidentical transplants changed all that. There's a randomized study. So now it's mostly blood, except there are occasions, if you have a patient with aplastic anemia, that potentially you might use bone marrow instead, but those are rare. So I think this is going to be an issue where you're just not going to have anyone who's going to be able to be credentialed because the field has changed.
And I think I'm getting his squeals. It goes for the processing as well. Because if you're not seeing marrows in the processing lab, you're not going to know how to process them. And processing a pediatric marrow is different than processing a marrow for an adult.
Yep.
So if you're starting with 600 mLs, it's very different than when you're starting with 2 liters. So it's going to carry through to the processing lab and how they manage these products. So the fact that we're not collecting them doesn't just mean we don't have people to collect. We also won't have people who know how to process them.
Yeah.
And those folks are retiring as well.
Okay, thank you, Dr.
This is Dr. Schmidt. It looks like there is no requirement that I can see regarding the processing of any marrows at all. It's mainly only processing of the stem cells from it just says hematopoietic progenitor processing procedures. It's very vague. It includes all of them. So I don't think we have a problem in the processing. It sounds like we only have a processing in the procurement.
We do. But in practice,
and I mean, we don't want people doing it who have no experience in doing it. That's the other end of the stick too.
No, you're correct. The processing is general to any source, and not specific to the three sources.
This is McCarthy again. The NMDP has been storing bone marrow that's been collected because for whatever reason wasn't used. So you can actually access marrow that they put away. And it's bringing up the point that they are likely going to have to be a central clearinghouse or whatever for processing. To Dr. Becker's point, you really have to have some expertise to be able to process bone marrow. And if you don't, the last time your lab has done one is 3 years ago. That's an issue. So I think this is a national problem. It's just not a New York State problem that we really need to reach out to, I think, the NMDP, other agencies, to see if a central locations can be developed for marrow to be processed in.
Yeah. It may not be a New York specific problem, but it's certainly acute or more acute in New York because of the regulations and licensure requirements that we have for the facilities, which is, I guess, a mixed blessing.
Yes.
So this is Dr. Schmidt again. What is the suggestion of what number of bone marrow collections that people are throwing out that would be a good number for someone to meet to be the director? I mean, obviously, everyone's saying 12 is way too many. I mean, it doesn't say 12 in whatever period of time, it says 12 overall. So.
Or is there some alternative criteria besides a specific number of procedures? Dr. Hilbert, you're on mute.
Yeah, I don't have a great answer for this, which is why I think we need to solicit, you know, some other opinions. I think that I've heard numbers thrown around. You know, you could make the argument. You could say 12 overall. You could say so many within the past 5 years. You could say as deemed appropriate by, you know, the institution or whatever. I mean, I know that you can't get credentialed at NYU or at any place probably if you don't have any experience, and it has to be deemed appropriate by your chief of service and the chief medical officer, and you can't schedule OR time if you don't have what they consider to be the appropriate experience and competence. So I think they also do look at it in terms of overall experience, you know, experience with bone marrow collections, bone marrow biopsies, patient management in these settings. So I don't have a simple answer, but I guess that's why we need to have experts let us know.
One more thing. A bone marrow biopsy is totally different than a bone marrow harvest.
And yeah, that, I know.
It's apples and oranges.
Can you turn yours off?
How long is the specimen viable? Between
one last thing is that the maintaining competency for low number products is not just linked to this. I do therapeutic apheresis, so if anybody maintains their competency in white blood cell reductions for the leukemia patients and some other low yield numbers, we have problems maintaining competency for all of our nurses for those procedures. So this is not just unique to this. This is something we're seeing throughout medicine.
And David, you had a question?
Yes, how long is the specimen viable between procurement and processing? Is there a set time? In other words, what I was just thinking, if you had several procurement areas or facilities and then one processing facility, let's say in New York City or Utica or wherever, is that a viable way to fill these positions? Because that would mean you need less directors of processing, and you still need the directors of medical
procurement.
Procurement, but you'd have less processing directors you'd need.
Yeah, if they're centralized locations. Well, NMDP, I think, serve, well, NMDP doesn't process themselves. New York Blood Center probably serves some of that function.
So the specimens last long enough to transport?
Between facilities, from one facility to another within the city? Dr. McCarthy?
It depends, of course, because marrow can last for about 48 hours before you have to use it. Either you freeze it or it goes into a patient. But you got to make sure it's harvested correctly and it's transported correctly. So, and again, if you're involved with a rare event, that's an issue. So the other option is, well, then where do you harvest it from? So sometimes the NMDP and all the other DKMS, all these other centers that do harvests, will send a donor to an appropriate center to get a harvest. And those appropriate centers are shrinking in number.
I mean, Matt, it seems like the number of facilities that are interested in providing these services is increasing. Is that just my experience, or is that...
No, I don't think we've seen a new licensee. We've seen some new, and not to pick on anyone in particular, Memorial Sloan Kettering has submitted some new applications recently, but they have existing applications that go back decades. They've just opened up another location, and because of the way our licenses work, the new location needs a license of its own. We have not seen a wholly new hematopoietic progenitor cell procurement facility in quite a while.
Okay. And storage and processing is the same? There's not a...
Again, there are some new labs, but they're all at existing institutions.
Okay.
One more thing, the field is changing, and there are now some randomized studies comparing bone marrow transplant or stem cell transplant in myeloma to CAR T cell therapy. And that study is ongoing in Europe, and they're trying to do it in the States. And if that may be a different product that you may need to be thinking about licensing, then that would be lymphocytes. Now, a lot of that is manufactured at a company off site and then sent back. But there are regulations, I'm sure. And there are certain ways of manufacturing lymphocytes at a center using a CD30 or a lymphocyte selection device. And then you do it yourself. So these are all changing. There are also allogeneic lymphocyte products that will be likely approved within the next few years. And that may be something to be thinking about as the field shifts.
Yeah, we do periodically get questions about CAR T cells or other types of immune cells. At the current time, the department is not regulating those as either blood or tissue products, but that may change. Okay, well, thank you for the thoughtful discussion. We will consider your comments. If there are other people or organizations that you think we should reach out to, please feel free to share those. You have my email address. And Dr. Hilbert's going to talk to his colleagues, and I welcome your feedback. And I just remind you that any specific revisions we've proposed to this regulation will come back to the council at some point for further discussion. So, we're not done, certainly. We will see you again. Very briefly, while we are on the subject of subpart 58-5, the department is considering revisions to part 52, the regulations that govern tissue banks. Subpart 58-5 makes specific reference to sections of Part 52, which may change with the revisions we have proposed. In this case, we will need to make conforming changes to subpart 58.5.
As an example, 58-5 currently references subpart 52.2, except for section 52-2.9. We anticipate that there may be changes to the numbering that affect section 52-2.9, and so we'll have to revise 58-5 to reference 52-2.9's replacement. As currently envisioned, any of these conforming changes in subpart 58.5 will not affect the substance. But we would like to bring this to your attention in case you do have any concerns. So very briefly, any questions on what I've just said? And if you kept 52 and 58.5 straight, all the more power to you on a Friday afternoon. Dr. Schmidt.
I had a question regarding something different than what you were talking about, but it's from our last topic of discussion where we were talking about there had been a question that was posed by the people, someone, somewhere, something, regarding the use of a second person to sign off on blood and to monitor a patient on a tablet. I don't know if there was anything else on that that has come up over the last year or any developments or questions or anything more on that.
Oh, I think that was about the use of a virtual RN, where there would be one individual at the bedside of the patient and then bring in a second RN through some sort of remote means. I have this, you know, we had some discussions around the time of our last meeting. I had some discussions with the Division of Hospitals and then I also had some discussions with the nursing board at the State Education Department, but we have not, as far as I know, that's not been adopted as a viable policy widespread. And there was no new development in the last year over that about people asking to adopt that as a means for, I believe we were looking at a context in as the bedside verification for the initiating a transfusion, and we said that that would not be acceptable at that time. Yeah. So, nothing new.
Okay. Anyone else? If not, we will move on to the public comment portion of the meeting. Are there any members of the public who wish to make comments today? If so, please state your name. Okay, hearing none, Dr. Hilbert.
Thank you all. That concludes today's agenda. You can hear me, right? Yeah, I'm unmuted. Okay.
Yes.
May I have a motion to adjourn this meeting?
I'll move to make it an adjournment. This is Rachel.
Thank you, Rachel. Seconded by anyone have a second?
Mr. McCarthy, I second it.
Any additional discussion? We'll do a roll call vote on the motion. Dr. Becker?
Approve.
Dr. Elder?
Approve.
Mr. Husky?
Approve.
Beverly?
Approve.
And Dr. Schmidt?
Approve.
Thank you all. We are adjourned.